This is Lecture 8 of the Foundations of Human Experience by Rudolf Steiner. This is the synopsis. Comparison of the processes of forgetting and remembering with those of falling asleep and awakening as exemplified disturbances in sleep. The process of remembering. Training the power to remember and the will through the effects of repetition. Strengthening memory through awakening intense interest. Comprehending human nature through division into components on the one side and the integration of components on the other. The 12 senses. Concerning the sense of I, capital, and the difference between the perception of another I, parenthesis, cognitive process, parenthesis, and the perception of one's own I, will process. The sense of thought, the division of the 12 senses into will-oriented senses, that are touch, life, movement, and balance, feeling-oriented senses, smell, taste, sight, and temperature, and cognitive senses, I, capital, thought, hearing, and speech. The division of the world by the 12 senses, and their reintegration through judgment. Comprehension of the spirit through levels of consciousness, waking, sleeping, dreaming, of the soul through states of life, sympathy, antipathy, and of the body through forms, sphere, crescent moon, and lines. End of synopsis. Lecture 8, given in Stuttgart, August 29th, 1919. Yesterday we saw that we can understand something like memory and remembering only when we relate it to processes more easily observed, namely to sleeping and waking. From this you can see that our pedagogical goal must be to bring the unknown closer and closer to the known. This is also true regarding the formation of spiritual ideas. You might say that sleeping and waking are more obscure than remembering and forgetting, and that for this reason an understanding of sleeping and waking will not contribute much to a discussion of remembering and forgetting. Nevertheless, if we carefully observe what people lose through restless sleep, we can infer something about how the failure to bring forgetting into a proper relationship with remembering disturbs all of human soul life. We know from experience that a reasonable amount of sleep is necessary to keep our consciousness from becoming weaker and weaker, to keep it from taking on the characteristic described by saying that, due to disturbed sleep, all kinds of things in our surroundings impress our I too strongly, capital I. Even with a relatively small disturbance during sleep, for example insomnia, you can see that this is the case. Suppose that during the night you did not sleep well, parenthesis, I am assuming that the reason you did not sleep is not because you were particularly active and used the night to work. In such a case, the situation is somewhat different, parenthesis. Suppose some physical condition, or perhaps mosquitoes, in other words, something external, disturbs your sleep. You may notice on the next day that things disturb you more than usual. In a sense, your capital I is more sensitive. It is much the same when forgetting and remembering play improperly into human soul life. When does that occur? It occurs when we are unable to use our will to regulate our forgetting and remembering. Many people daydream through life, and we can already see this tendency in early childhood. Something in their surroundings makes an impression upon them and gains their attention, but they do not properly follow this impression. Instead, they let it whoosh by. In a sense, they do not properly connect their capital I with the impression. Since they are not really interested in their surroundings, they also daydream in randomly occurring images. They do not purposely seek to increase the store of thoughts necessary to understand something well in any given occasion. Instead, they allow the images that arise within to come up by themselves. One image appears, and then soon another, and the free will has no particular influence upon the process. In many respects, this is the state of soul for many people, but it arises especially during childhood. We can help bring remembering and forgetting increasingly into the realm of the will if we know that sleeping and waking play a role in remembering and forgetting during our waking hours. We can ask, where does remembering come from? It comes about because the will, in which we are asleep, takes an image from deep in the unconscious and brings it into consciousness. The strength of the sleeping will causes the process of remembering in the same way that the human, capital I, and the astral body gather strength in the spiritual world between sleeping and awakening to refresh the physical and the etheric bodies. However, the will is sleeping, and therefore you cannot directly make children learn to use their will. Wanting to make children use their will is the same thing as telling people to be well behaved during sleep, so that they can bring this good behavior into their lives when they awaken in the morning. We cannot, therefore, expect the sleeping will to pull itself together to directly control the process of remembering. What can we do? We cannot, of course, expect children to pull themselves together in specific instances to control the process of remembering, but we can raise children so that they develop habits of soul, body, and spirit that lead to this kind of focusing of the will. Let us look at this in more detail. Suppose, for example, that through a particular method you awaken in the children a lively interest in the animal kingdom. Of course, you cannot develop it in a single day. You will have to arrange the instruction so that an interest in the animal kingdom gradually develops and awakens. When children undergo such instruction, the more lively their awakened interest is, the more the instruction affects their will. If, in the normal course of life, they need to remember ideas about animals, the will is then able to bring these up from the subconscious and out of forgetfulness. Only when you affect what is habitual in people can you bring order into their will, and thus into their power of remembering. In other words, you must see why everything that awakens intense interest in children also helps strengthen their memory. We must increase the power to remember through the feeling and will, and not through simple intellectual memory exercises. You can thus see how the world, particularly the human world, in a sense consists of separate parts, and how those separate parts work together. We cannot understand the human soul if we do not separate the soul into its thinking or thinking cognition, feeling, and willing parts. However, thinking, cognition, feeling, and willing are not present in a pure form anywhere. The three things work together and are interwoven into a unity. That is also true of human nature in its entirety, right into the physical. I have already mentioned to you that the human being is primarily head in his or her head, but that in fact the head aspect exists everywhere in the human body. As a chest being, humans are mostly chest, but they are actually a chest being everywhere, because the head also has something of a chest nature, as do the limbs. As a being of limbs, the human being is primarily limb, but actually the whole human being is a limb being, since the characteristic of the limbs exists in the head as well as the chest. For example, the limbs are involved with breathing through the skin, and so forth. If we want to come closer to reality, particularly the reality of human nature, then we must clearly take all separation in the context of unity. If we only focused upon abstract unity, we could not understand anything. If we never separated things, the world would remain vague, as when all cats in the night seem gray. People who want to understand everything in abstractions see the world as only gray. If we only divide and separate and keep things apart, we never come to a real understanding, because we then comprehend only differences, and understanding is absent. The nature of everything that constitutes a human being is partly cognitive, partly feeling, and partly willing. What is cognitive is mainly cognitive, but also has aspects of feeling and willing. What is feeling is mainly feeling, but also has cognitive and willing aspects. It is the same with willing. We can now apply that to what I described yesterday as the sense realm. If you really want to understand what I now want to present, you must rid yourselves of all pedantry. Otherwise you may find the crassest contradiction to what I said in yesterday's lecture. However, reality consists of contradictions. We do not comprehend reality if we do not look at the contradictions of the world. Altogether, the human being has 12 senses. The reason normal science recognizes only 5, 6, or 7 senses is that these senses are particularly obvious, and the remainder are less obvious. I have often mentioned the 12 human senses, but today we want to recall them again in our souls. Usually people speak of the senses of hearing, temperature, sight, taste, smell, and touch. Sometimes the senses of temperature and touch are combined, which is like saying smoke and dust are the same because their appearance is similar. Actually, it should no longer be necessary to mention that the senses of temperature and touch are two very different human characteristics and are two different ways that human beings relate to the world. At best, modern psychologists differentiate these two senses and perhaps add the sense of balance. Some people add one more sense. However, it is not included in sense physiology or sense psychology, because people simply do not see that human beings, when perceiving the capital I of other human beings, have a similar relationship to the world, similar to the one they have when perceiving color with their sense of sight. Today people tend to mix everything together. When people think about the idea of the capital I, they first think of the nature of their own soul and are then satisfied. Psychologists do something similar. They do not consider that if I collect all my experiences and call the sum of these experiences I, it is very different from what I refer to when I meet someone and relate to another person, such that I also refer to that person as an I. These are two very different activities of the spirit soul. When I summarize my life's activities with a comprehensive term I have something purely within me. When I meet another person and through my relationship to that person express that he or she has something like my I engage in the interplay that flows between me and the other person. I must therefore say that the perception of my own I within me is something different from recognizing the I of another person. The perception of the other person's I is founded in the I sense, in the same way that the perception of color is based upon the sense of sight, or tone upon the sense of hearing. Nature does not make the organ for, quote, I-ing, unquote, in other words, I-ing, of I-ing, I guess, as easy, okay, I'll read that over. Nature does not make the organ for, quote, unquote, I-ing, as easy for people to recognize as the organ for seeing. However, we could well use the word eyeing for the perceiving of another's eye, just as we use the word seeing for perceiving colors. The organ in human beings for perceiving colors is on the surface, but the organ for perceiving the eye spreads over the entire human being and consists of a very subtle substance. For that reason, people do not speak of an organ for perceiving another's eye. This eyeing organ is different from what enables me to experience my own I. There is, in fact, a tremendous difference between experiencing my own I and perceiving the I of another person. Perceiving of someone else's I is primarily a cognitive process, or at least a process similar to cognition, but experiencing my own I is a will process. We now have something to which a pedant could easily object, saying that in the last lecture I said all sense activity is primarily will activity, but now I have just created an I sense and say it is primarily a cognitive sense. However, if you characterize the I sense in this way, I have attempted in my recent edition of Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, a Philosophy of Freedom, you would realize that this I sense works in a very complicated way. What is the basis of actually perceiving the I of another human being? Modern abstractionists say quite peculiar things. They say that actually we see people's form, hear their tones, and then know we look just as human as they do and have within ourselves a being that thinks, feels, and wills, and is therefore also a human being in a soul-spiritual sense. Thus, through analogy, I conclude that just as I am a thinking, feeling, and willing being, it is the same with others. I make a conclusion about others through analogy with myself. This conclusion is nothing more than folly. The interrelationship between one person and another involves something quite different. If you meet another person, the following occurs. For a short period, you perceive a person, and he or she makes an impression upon you. That impression disturbs you inwardly. You feel that person. No, you feel that the person, a being comparable to yourself, makes an impression upon you like an attack. The result is that you defend yourself inwardly. You resist this attack and become inwardly aggressive toward the person. In this aggression, you become crippled, and the aggression ceases. Then the other person can again make an impression upon you, and after you thus have time to regain your aggressive strength, you carry out another act of aggression. Again, you become numb, and the other person again makes an impression upon you, and so forth. This is the relationship that exists when one person meets another and perceives the other I, that is, devotion to the other, inner resistance, sympathy, antipathy. I am not speaking now of feeling, but just the perception of meeting. The soul vibrates. It vibrates sympathy, antipathy, sympathy, antipathy, sympathy, antipathy. You can read about this in the new edition of Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path. However, there is still something else. As sympathy develops, you go to sleep in the other person. As antipathy develops, you wake up, and so forth. In the vibrations of meeting another person, there is a rapid alternation between waking and sleeping. We have to thank the organ of the eye sense that this can occur. This organ of eye sensing is so formed that it explores the eye of another person, not wakefully, but in its sleeping will, and then quickly delivers the results of this sleepy exploration to cognition, that is, to the nervous system. If we look at these things properly, the main thing in perceiving another person is the will. But the will as developed not in wakefulness, but in sleep. We continually include sleeping moments in the act of perceiving the eye of another, and what lies in between is cognition. This moves quickly into the area where the nervous system lives, such that I can indeed call the perceiving of another person a cognitive process. However, I must realize that this cognitive process is only a metamorphosis of a sleeping will process. Thus, this sense process is a will process, only we do not recognize it as such. We are not conscious in the cognition we experience in sleep. The next sense we have to consider is separate from the eye sense and all the other senses. I call it the sense of thought. The sense of thought is not a sense for perceiving our own thoughts, but for perceiving the thoughts of other people. Psychologists have developed grotesque ideas about it. As a whole, people are so impressed by the connection between speech and thinking that they believe we apprehend thoughts with speech. This is ridiculous, since through your sense of thought, you can perceive thoughts in gestures, just as you can perceive them in speech. Speech only transmits thoughts. You must perceive thoughts through your sense of thought. When we have finally created all the sounds of speech as movement forms in eurythmy, then someone would need only to perform them eurythmically, and out of these movements you could read the thoughts, just as you can hear them through speech. In short, the sense of thought is something different from what is active in the sense of speech. There we have the specific sense of speech. We then have the senses of hearing, temperature, sight, taste, and smell. Next we have a sense of balance. We have a sense-like consciousness that we are in balance. We have such an awareness. Through a specific inner sense perception, we know how to orient ourselves left and right, front and back. We know how to maintain our balance so that we do not fall. If the organ of our sense of balance were destroyed, we would fall. We could not maintain our balance, just as we could not relate to colors if our EYEI were destroyed. In the same way that we have a sense for perceiving our balance, we also have a sense of our own movement, through which we can differentiate whether we are still or moving, and whether we are flexing our muscles. Thus, along with a sense of balance, we also have a sense of movement. Besides that, we also have a sense for perceiving the condition of our body in the broadest sense, the sense of life. Many people are very dependent upon this sense of life. They perceive whether they have eaten too much or too little, or whether they are tired or not, or whether they feel comfortable or uncomfortable. In short, the states of our own bodies are reflected in the sense of life. Thus we have a total of 12 senses. Human beings have in truth 12 such senses. By recognizing that our understanding of the senses is based upon will, we have eliminated possible pedantic objections to their existence. We can now further divide the senses. First, we have the four senses of touch, life, movement, and balance. These senses are primarily permeated by will. They are, again, touch, life, movement, and balance. Back to Steiner. Will acts through these senses in perception. Feel, for example, how will acts in perceiving movement, even if you move while standing still. The resting will also acts in the perception of balance. Will is very active in the sense of life, and it is active when you explore your surroundings through touch, because touching something is basically a negotiation between your will and the surroundings. In short, we can say that the senses of balance, movement, life, and touch are will senses in the narrower sense. For example, your hand moves when you examine something by touch, so it is obvious that the sense of touch exists. The existence of the senses of life, movement, and balance is not so obvious. However, because these are will senses in a special sense, and the will sleeps, people sleep through these senses. In most psychological theories, you will not find these senses even mentioned, because regarding many things, science comfortably sleeps the sleep of the human being. The next group of senses, namely smell, taste, sight, and temperature, are primarily senses of feeling. The naive consciousness particularly feels the relationship of smelling and tasting to feeling. There are particular reasons why people do not feel that relationship with sight and temperature. Because sense of temperature is thrown together with the sense of touch, people do not notice that it is closely related to feeling. Things are at once incorrectly combined and incorrectly differentiated. The sense of touch is, in truth, much more will-oriented, whereas the sense of temperature is oriented only toward feeling. People do not realize that the sense of sight is also a feeling sense, because they do not observe such things as are found in Goethe's color theory. There Goethe clearly sets forth the relationship of color to feeling, and how it finally leads to will impulses. However, why do people so little notice that, in the sense of sight, feeling predominates? We nearly always see things so that when they give the colors to us, they also show us the boundaries of colors, namely lines and forms. We are not normally aware of how we perceive when we perceive color and form at the same time. Someone who perceives a colored circle might say, quote, "I see the color, and I see the roundness of the circle or the circular form," unquote. However, here, two very different things are confused. At first, you see only the color through the specific activity of the eye, iwai. You see the circular form when you subconsciously use the sense of movement and unconsciously make a circular movement in the etheric or astral body, thus raising it into cognition. Let me read that again. You see the circular form when you subconsciously use the sense of movement and unconsciously make a circular movement in the etheric or astral body, thus raising it into cognition. When the circle you have apprehended through your sense of movement rises to cognition, it is then joined with the perceived color. You take the form out of your entire body when you appeal to the sense of movement spread out over your entire body. You clothe yourself in something that I previously discussed when I said that human beings actually perform geometric forms in the cosmos and then raise them into cognition. Today, official science is not at all interested in such a refined way of observation. so it does not distinguish between seeing color and perceiving form with the help of the sense of movement, but mixes everything together. In the future, however, we will not be able to educate with such confusion. How will it be possible to educate human seeing if we do not know that the whole human being participates in seeing through the sense of movement? Now, something else arises. You think about seeing when you perceive colored forms. Seeing, the perceiving of colored forms, is a complicated activity. Because you are a whole human being, you can inwardly reunite the two things you perceive through sight and the sense of movement. You would numbly gaze at a red circle if you did not perceive the color red and the circular form through quite different means. However, you do not gaze numbly because you perceive things from two sides, namely color through the eye and form with the help of the sense of movement. In life, you must again integrate these two things. Then you form a judgment, and thus you can now comprehend judging as a living bodily process that arises because your senses present you with the world analyzed into parts. The world you experience comes to you in 12 different ways, and you reunite things through your judging, because individual things do not want to remain individual. The circular form does not accept being simply a circular form as presented through the sense of movement. Color does not accept being simply color as perceived by the eye. Things force you to reunite them, and you declare yourself inwardly ready to forge the connection. Here the act of judgment becomes an expression of your entire human being. Now you can see the deeper meaning of our relationship to the world. If we did not have 12 senses, we would look at our surroundings like idiots and could not experience inner judgment. However, because we do have 12 senses, we have a large number of possible ways to reunite what has been separated. What the sense of capital I experiences, we can connect with the other 11 senses, and the same is true for each sense. In this way, we have a large number of combined relationships between the senses. Besides that, we also have a large number of possibilities when, for example, we connect the sense of capital I with both the senses of thought and speech. In this way, we can see the mysterious way human beings are connected with the world. The 12 senses separate things into their basic elements, and the human being must be able to put them back together again. In this way, people participate in the inner life of things. You can therefore understand how immensely important it is that we educate children and develop each of the senses in balance, since we can then systematically and consciously seek the relationships between the senses and perceptions. I need to add that the sense of capital I and the senses of thought, hearing, and speech are more cognitive senses, because the will in them is more the sleeping will, the really sleeping will that vibrates in cognitive activity. Thus, will, feeling, and cognition live in the capital I region of human beings with the help of waking and sleeping. We need to be clear that when we look at the spirit, we can understand human beings only when we view them from three standpoints. However, it is not sufficient to always say, spirit, spirit, spirit. Most people continually talk about spirit, but do not know what to do with what spirit gives. We only properly take care of what is spirit-given when we work with states of consciousness. We must affect the spirit through states of consciousness, such as waking, sleeping, and dreaming. The soul is affected through sympathy and antipathy, that is, through the conditions met in life. The soul is affected continuously in the subconscious. The soul exists in the astral body and life in the etheric body. Between them is a continuous inner communication, such that the soul automatically participates in the living conditions of the etheric body. The physical body is perceived through its forms. Yesterday I used the sphere for the head, the crescent moon for the chest, and lines for the limbs. But we still need to speak about the actual morphology of the human body. We do not correctly speak about the spirit if we do not describe its existence in states of consciousness. We do not correctly speak about the soul if we do not reveal its life between sympathy and antipathy. We do not correctly speak about the physical body if we do not comprehend its true forms. We will speak more of this tomorrow. The end of Lecture 8.